So let's begin. And, you know, this is just kind of a rounds thing. This is not an A to Z course. We just want to kind of catch your attention a little bit and provide some stuff to you that might be helpful. I wanted to get just a feel, first of all, in terms of who's so watching here tonight and how often you see patients with bladder cancer. So for the attendees, if you could just click on the answer, tell us when the last time was that you encountered a patient with bladder cancer in your practice. And I want to begin, as we're sort of waiting to see how people respond to that, and ask Anastasia if you can just talk a little bit about the typical sequence of how somebody typically presents with bladder cancer and the initial management. And you can see that it looks like half of the audience has seen a patient with bladder cancer in the last month. So Anastasia, can you kind of begin to paint a little bit of a picture?
A lot of our patients first present either with gross hematuria or blood seen on urinalysis. A lot of our patients have frequent UTIs that were not resolved with antibiotics. Some of them have pelvic pain and discomfort with urination. So those are the typical symptoms of bladder cancer.
And Arjun, another issue that's kind of interesting about bladder cancer, we think of lung cancer as being very related to tobacco and smoking, but also it's a very important risk factor. We put this up actually as a question for the audience to answer in terms of risk factors. I think most people are aware of the fact that smoking is a risk factor. Can you talk a little bit, Arjun, about the typical patient that you see with bladder cancer, both as it relates to previous history, age, et cetera?
Yeah, so I think the so-called garden variety patient with bladder cancer is someone generally in their late 60s, early 70s, usually a man, and usually it's a gentleman who's had a long-standing history of tobacco smoking. Some are still current smokers. A lot of them are former smokers, and often the history is like, oh, I quit, you know, 15, 20 years ago. How could I have bladder cancer? And along with the smoking history is all the other stuff that comes along with it, hypertension, chronic kidney disease, sometimes diabetes, and a lot of other stuff. And so these patients come to our door with a lot of other medical problems in addition, and then they're diagnosed with bladder cancer.
So Susan, we're going to talk about non-invasive bladder cancer, which sometimes it sort of precedes invasive bladder cancer and what that's all about. But one of the central issues in bladder cancer is the surgical management, specifically cystectomy. Can you talk a little bit about what patients go through with that?
Well, it's removal of the bladder. In men, you're also taking out the prostate and the bladder. In women, you're also taking out the uterus. And if you're taking out the bladder, they're going to make a new bladder. Like the more typical way was to make an ileal conduit. So they kind of make an ostomy and then they have an external flow of urine. More recently, if people are selected for this, they can do continent bladders. So they fashion a bladder inside that either there's one type that they can actually, they void through their urethra, but by kind of bearing down. And another way, they have like a small hole in their belly, like near their belly button, where they actually catheterize themselves. So that's not an option for everybody. And a lot of people want to hold on to their bladders. And so that comes up in a lot of discussion of how the bladder cancer is going to be managed, particularly if it's muscle invasive.
Anastasia, can you talk also a little bit more about some of the issues that come up both with the stomas and how the stomal therapists are integrated into the patient's management?
I think that, as Susan said, that this is one of the biggest barriers for patients to proceed with cystectomy, the fact that they're not able to go to the bathroom the usual way. The neobladder is an excellent choice for patients who want to preserve their urinary function. However, it's a lot of times very hard to manage. A lot of times patients have urine retention and frequent UTIs and a lot of complications related to it. The other more traditional stoma can be sometimes easier managed, but a lot of times having great ostomy nurses is important, having the right supplies, and also focusing on educating the patient to care appropriately for it are very important.
So Arjun, another question that comes up, and you see this, and we've already talked about this issue, for example, I can't remember last week, we were talking about ovarian cancer. The question of, do you send the patient directly to surgery or do systemic therapy first, neoadjuvant treatment? And there's been a lot of debate about that. Can you kind of summarize where we are today right now, Arjun, about this decision of, do you send the patient with muscle invasive disease to surgery or give him systemic therapy first?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that there is a debate because the standard of care and what improves survival and cure rates is neoadjuvant chemotherapy with cisplatin-based treatment before cystectomy. There's level one evidence, 3 randomized trials, large meta-analysis of additional studies. So it's definitive proof. When we add perioperative treatment to cystectomy, it improves survival. The important considerations here are, number one, that it has to be cisplatinum. Other agents have not been shown to demonstrate this, so the patient has to be eligible for cisplatinum. And also, it's ideally given in the neoadjuvant setting. You know, people have argued, neoadjuvant, adjuvant, it's all the same. Why not do the cystectomy now and try to give the chemo after? But the problem is that this is a highly morbid surgery. It is life-altering. You know, it's a 3-month recovery period. It's about a 4-5% mortality rate. And these patients really are not excited about getting chemotherapy after they've basically been run over by a train with this surgery. And so the ideal opportunity to do it is in the neoadjuvant setting. That's the safest window. And you get the benefit of doing what's called an in vivo assessment. So you know how well the chemo worked when you did the cystectomy. So it has prognostic value too.
So I'm curious, Arjun, we could spend a lot of time, and we've done entire seminars on the whole issue of COVID, but I am curious, in New York and other places, Boston, where there's been a lot of COVID, you see a shift towards more neoadjuvant therapy because docs and nurses didn't want to put patients in the hospital at this time. Yeah. Is that what happened at your place?
It did. I mean, so, you know, Peter and I were both at academic centers where, you know, we adhere to level one evidence and, you know, we offer cisplatin-based chemotherapy to all eligible patients. What was also happening is that some of the patients who are kind of on the edge where you might not have necessarily fit the standard of care and they don't have documented muscle invasive disease, but they're highly invasive in the lamina propria. Maybe they have some hydro, but you haven't proven muscle invasive. You know, those are the patients who might have gone directly to cystectomy because you don't have biopsy proven muscle invasive cancer. I had 1 or 2 patients in that really critical time period of April when our rates were just so high and our hospital was 100% COVID. And so for those patients, we kind of went a little bit outside of the standard of care and gave them neoadjuvant. So we expanded the population a little bit. But I still think that, you know, we should be adhering to standards of care.
Susan, any comments about neoadjuvant therapy and how you see patients going through that and how they respond to the idea of neoadjuvant as opposed to going to surgery?
Yeah, I would say by and large, people are more interested in trying to get the biggest bang for their buck. And while there are some people that say, no, no way, I don't want chemo, a lot of them like the idea of being able to do as much as they can. We're also doing it, you know, in a dose-dense fashion. So we're doing it every 2 weeks so that under usual circumstances, you're getting 6 weeks of chemo, not 3 months of chemo before waiting to go to surgery. So I find it's very well tolerated. Well, I mean, it can sometimes be very difficult, but at the same time, we have better drugs to manage side effects than we did even 20 years ago, and it makes a big difference. We can get people through it.
Anastasia, Arjun mentioned, I think, the idea of nephrostomy, and maybe you could comment a little bit on the issue of obstruction of the ureters and how that's dealt with in bladder cancer.
So we always monitor our patients in regards to kidney function, but a lot of times that's managed mostly by urology. Definitely doing the appropriate workup, placing nephrostomy tubes, stents when it's necessary is important. It is a barrier if somebody has an obstruction and elevated creatinine to giving them neoadjuvant treatment. But if we do the management appropriately, a lot of times their creatinine can improve to a level where we can give cisplatin chemotherapy.
So Peter, one of the things that sort of jumped on the scene recently was the whole issue of treating patients with immunotherapy who have non-invasive disease. And we're going to talk about that because it's such an interesting concept. But first, just to maybe look a little bit at the anatomy, if we can take a look at the slide here of, you know, sort of how bladder cancer evolves. Can you comment on that, Peter? And then we'll go with the next slide that talks about the sort of invasiveness.
It's not uncommon for the time when a medical oncology, you know, professional would be seeing a patient that patient has been battling bladder cancer for years up to that point, because oftentimes these cancers, as you mentioned, start as non-invasive cancers that are, you know, not invading that muscle layer of the bladder, and they have been managed by a urologist who has performed, you know, repeated cystoscopies and transurethral resections of those small early stage bladder tumors and have successfully managed the patient through that strategy for often many years. And it actually makes it more difficult when the time comes for that patient to really think about a cystectomy, when And we should say it out loud, you know, when a patient has muscle invasive disease, they need to have a cystectomy. You know, whether or not there's neoadjuvant chemo involved, the gold standard is removal of the bladder at that point. And so that's a hard conversation for patients to hear, because they've said, well, you know, we've been managing this with, you know, scraping it away for many years now. And why can't I do that, doc?
So Arjun, maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of what non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is, and at this point, how we're managing it or how it has been managed.
Yeah, so I think this slide here is, you know, quite illustrative. Non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is roughly about 75% of the incident cases every year. Prevalence is quite high because many patients can live with non-muscle invasive disease, as, you know, Dr. Donald just mentioned, for many years. So there's quite a lot of people out there with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And it has two forms. There's carcinoma in situ, which is kind of this plaque-like diffuse cancer that is just in the lining of the bladder. And it's kind of adherent. It's all over the place. Usually once you see it in one part, you're probably going to see it in other parts. And then there's papillary tumors. And papillary tumors are really discrete collections of cancer cells that either grow into the empty lumen of the bladder, papillary tumors like TA, so that's what that is. And then, or they can choose to be invasive and they kind of grow inwards, you know, through the basement membrane into the lamina propria. And so it's important that even those tumors are invasive, and many of the urologists who see this cancer every day will tell you, you know, T1 disease is simply not muscle invasive yet. And so what we think of in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is actually a heterogeneous group of diseases. And then it's also the issue of grade, right? So low-grade tumors versus high-grade tumors. High-grade tumors, meaning the individual cancer cells are high-grade, those are the ones that can develop into more invasive disease and then muscle-invasive disease. So high-risk non-muscle-invasive bladder cancer is essentially high-grade disease, and it can manifest as carcinoma in situ or papillary tumors. And we classically treat these patients with a transurethral resection of bladder tumor, TURBT. It's a procedure that's done in the operating room. It's a rigid cystoscope. It's a aggressive scraping, and you sample the muscle layer below the tumor to make sure it's not invasive into the muscle. And usually for high-grade disease, we treat with intravesical BCG, which is an attenuated mycobacterium bovis. It's very effective. 70% of people will respond to this treatment, but about half of those will still either relapse or develop persistent disease. And there, that's the tough conversation about cystectomy, because untreated and progressive high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that is not responsive to BCG carries a high risk of developing metastasis. And so even those patients, you know, need to be treated with cystectomy.
So we're going to talk about new developments as it relates to non-muscle invasive disease. But first, let's get into a case. And I always like cases that begin 85-year-old because those are always interesting. So maybe we can hear a little bit about this patient, Susan, the 85-year-old man.
So he is a widower, a prior smoker, but again, remote smoker. And his past medical history was that he had stage 4 kidney disease. He actually had an AV fistula placed because they are like poised to start him on dialysis, but he hasn't needed to use it. Hypertension, reflux disease, anemia related to chronic disease and his kidney disease, as well as chronic back pain. And his chronic back pain is like related to degenerative disease. So, you know, he kind of hobbles with a cane and goes to a chiropractor every other week. So he, about a year ago, did have non-muscle invasive disease. He presented with gross hematuria. He also had obstructed ureters, and he had to have a nephrostomy tube placed because he had hydronephrosis at the time of his original TURBT. When they followed up, you know, every 3 months, two, 3 months, again, they kept finding recurrent disease. It was still non-muscle invasive. He was treated with BCG. And then last November, when he was due to have another bladder resection, he was found to be very anemic with a hemoglobin of 5. And at that time, he was found to have muscle invasive disease. So I think, you know, even if he didn't have muscle invasive disease in this setting, he might have been somebody who was a candidate for a cystectomy were he medically fit for a cystectomy. But he had muscle invasive disease. Because of his kidney disease, he was not eligible to get platinum. And they did molecular testing on his bladder tumor and found that it was PD-L1 positive. So we started him on treatment with pembrolizumab. He also had very locally advanced disease. It was basically going through, looking on a CAT scan what his tumor looked like. It was going close to the rectum. You couldn't tell because you didn't have contrast, but it looked like it might have been invading the rectum, and it was going into the fat around the bladder. So he had very locally advanced disease. So we started on pembrolizumab initially every 3 weeks, 200 milligrams intravenous. And he did respond to it, at least it appeared to. It was hard to tell in the imaging, but when he had his cystoscopy to go and change his ureteral stent, they didn't see any gross tumor anymore. So that was a pretty good thing. What we ended up doing was changing him to every 6 weeks pembrolizumab. It's just so interesting that I made the decision to do that early in the pandemic because he was due to come in when we were trying to say, don't bring anybody in unless they absolutely have to. And I said, well, let's just, you know, wait 6 weeks for him. And then almost simultaneously, pembrolizumab got the approval to be given every 6 weeks at the 400 milligram dose. So he's doing okay. Next imaging, we'll look with an MRI so we can really take a look and see what's going on.
So a lot of interesting things about this case. Anastasia, what about this issue of Q6 weeks, Pembro? And you know, we've seen other increasing interval and other checkpoint inhibitors. We brought this up, I think it was Tuesday, in the lung cancer meeting. And the lung cancer people were not exactly ready to jump all over it. They were like, you know, we don't know. What's going on in your place, Anastasia? Are you going for Q6 now?
We are. We used to also give nivolumab every 2 weeks. So we've transitioned nivolumab every 4 weeks as well. So we are definitely trying to reduce the number of visits. But for some patients who are more symptomatic or they have grade 1 toxicities, we may keep them on the more frequent dosing in order for us to closely monitor their symptoms and make sure that we catch worsening of those toxicities earlier on.
So, Peter, this case has got a number of really great teaching points, and one has to do with platinum eligibility. A lot of these patients are older. Many of them have comorbidities like this man. How do you think through the issue of whether you're going to give them a platinum and whether you're going to give them cisplatinum or carbo?
Yeah, great question. Really relevant for this population. So, you know, as Arjun mentioned, the preferred drug is cisplatin here. There are clear data in bladder cancer, the cisplatin is superior to carboplatin. You know, it's unlike probably lung cancer where they appear interchangeable. In bladder cancer, we don't think that. So you always try to give your patients cisplatin if they're eligible. This patient clearly had multiple factors that made them cisplatin ineligible, the chronic kidney disease, the poor performance status, the hearing loss. So you're thinking about, you know, then the role of using carboplatin-based therapy, which really has never been shown to extend survival for this disease. And, you know, that's really where immunotherapy becomes attractive in the right patient, right setting, because it has this potential for long-term durable disease control like we're seeing, you know, in this patient. And, you know, a patient with these types of risk factors and, you know, at age 85 and probably poor performance status here, the thought of giving even carboplatin-based therapy is not exciting. You know, there's even a study that showed that, you know, for patients who have poor performance status and poor renal function, that actually toxicity outweighs any benefit that you get from carboplatin-based therapy in those poor performance status patients. And so I really think the choice of immunotherapy here was probably the only one.
So interesting that he seems to do so well. Susan, did he have any autoimmune toxicity? Any toxicity from treatment at all?
He scared me a few times because he, you know, would show up not telling me, but he had diarrhea, turned out to be food-related. And then the first time I met him, actually, he had already been starting on it. And he's telling me that, you know, I can't walk. And I thought he had myopathy. But then I kind of delved into it and realized that this is a chronic problem that he's had forever. I kind of add that, you know, even though I switched him to every 6 weeks, I'm calling him every 3 weeks just to make sure that I'm not missing something coming up.
Yeah, that was one of the things the lung people brought up, that they want to see the patient, make sure everything's okay. But of course, you don't need to treat the patient to be able to check them out, particularly nowadays that we're using so much telemedicine. So let's talk a little bit with that kind of case as a background. This man presented with non-metastatic disease and then had disease that actually wasn't able to be resected because of his clinical status.